This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
That slight squeeze you've been feeling in your wallet, the one that gets you as you fill up your gas tank or top off on home heating oil, well, I'm sorry to be the one to break it to you, but it's only going to get worse. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, representing America's public transportation industry, delivering 10 billion riders annually, and working for an energy-independent America. Publictransportation.org. And by Bank of America, believing that healthy communities and a healthy planet are essential to creating opportunities for everyone. Bank of America, Bank of Opportunity.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's September 21st today. It's a Friday, and it's good to have you with us. One hates to ruin a perfectly fine Friday, but have you seen the price of a barrel of oil lately? Sure, crude fell 16 cents today to close at $81.62 a barrel in New York, but it's still closer to $100 than it is to $50, up 35% since January, 17% in just the past month. And yet, somehow, the mysteries of the refining pipeline have kept gas prices essentially flat since the beginning of summer. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler explains the disconnect and why it's not expected to last.
Higher crude oil prices didn't bump up gasoline prices over the last month, in part because refiners still had a fat profit margin. But that margin is getting thinner. And with demand for gas falling in the wake of the summer travel season, gas stations have been reluctant to raise prices at the pumps.
There are many, many places across the country where if you pull in, you buy gasoline, they're not making any money on the gasoline, might even be losing a little money, and they hope that you go inside and buy some expensive coffee or expensive in-store items because that's the only place that there's a profit margin at the moment.
That's Tom Closa, chief oil analyst with Oil Price Information Service. Going forward, he expects that every time the price of crude oil goes up a buck, retail gasoline prices will increase by 2.5 cents.
We're going to see increases as crude goes up from now on. It has to, or else you're going to see bankruptcy signs on some of the service station chains.
Others expect the rise in gas prices will be more modest. Justin Perucci is an equity analyst at Morningstar.
Maybe in the near term, we might see gasoline prices increase slightly just due to the price of oil. And some refiners also will be going down over the next few weeks to gear up for the winter heating season.
Even if all the refineries were up and running, there still wouldn't be enough of them to handle demand. Today, Royal Dutch Shell said that it would double the capacity of its Texas refinery, but that won't have an immediate impact on gas prices. The facility won't be ready until 2010. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
$2.78 a gallon is the national average for regular unleaded, for now at least. There was another major recall of Chinese-made goods today. The Consumer Product Safety Commission announced a voluntary recall of 1 million cribs due to worries about suffocation. They're manufactured and marketed under the brand names Simplicity for Children and Graco. Meanwhile, the company at the center of this summer's big toy recalls, Mattel, had something interesting to say today. Essentially, oops. Our New York Bureau Chief Jill Barchet has that story.
Love may mean never having to say you're sorry, but business is another matter. Today, a Mattel executive met with a Chinese official in Beijing. The Mattel exec apologized for harming China's reputation. It was really Mattel's design flaws, not China's shoddy manufacturing, he said. He went even further than that. He said Mattel had recalled too many lead-painted toys, even ones that were safe.
And I find it hard to believe that they would have recalled products that didn't need to be recalled. It's irrational to me.
And that's Richard Gottlieb. He's a toy manufacturing consultant.
For Mattel to have gone through the expense, to have damaged their brand equity, to have had the cost of taking these products back, and then to have lost the sales that these products would have represented, is enormous.
Gottlieb wonders if politics weren't at play. Mattel did not return our phone calls. Ulysse Payne is president of Addison Clifton. He advises U.S. companies that do business in China. Payne says the apology shows how savvy Mattel is about the local Chinese market.
And the biggest thing is admitting mistakes. It will go a long way in what they call guanji. Guanji is personal relationships. Even if you don't believe 100% you were totally at fault, if it helps keep the harmonious relationship, that is most important in China.
Mattel's going to need harmony if its long-term plans in China are to succeed. It wants to keep producing toys there. The company wants to sell there, too. Mattel announced today it's investing $30 million in a Barbie store in Shanghai. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay from Marketplace.
Just like Mattel's brand equity is going to take a while to recover, so is its share price, up 1.6% today, nibbling away at the 20% or so it's lost since the first recall back in June. Last night, the Senate passed a bill funding the Food and Drug Administration. The agency also got new powers to monitor drugs more carefully after they hit the market. That was the nub of the complaint about Vioxx 3 or so years ago. But the bill didn't go quite as far as some consumer advocates had hoped when it comes to reining in drug ads. From Washington, Marketplace's Steve Henn explains.
Zoloft is not for everyone.
But apparently drug ads on TV are for everyone.
Side effects may include dry mouth, insomnia, sexual side effects, diarrhea, nausea, and sleepiness.
When used correctly, these ads are good for you, according to Jim Davidson, executive director of the Advertising Coalition.
It's just more information, and more information is always better.
Vioxx is here.
All I really want is to be able to climb the stairs and give Michael a bath.
Merck spent more than $500 million advertising Vioxx. The painkiller became a blockbuster before studies linked it to an increased risk of heart problems. David Vladek, a law professor at Georgetown University, blames Vioxx ads for exacerbating a public health crisis.
There were, over 100 million prescriptions written for Vioxx in just a few years. These were the most heavily promoted drugs in recent memory.
The law passed last night gives the FDA new powers to fine drug makers for misleading ads, but won't allow the FDA to ban advertising for new drugs or force ads off the air. Broadcasters and advertisers like Jim Davidson beat that idea down, saying drug advertising was protected by the First Amendment.
It empowers consumers. It helps them have more informed conversations with their doctors. And it improves the level of quality for the healthcare system.
Pharmaceutical companies spent $5.3 billion on advertising last year, and drug ads are among the fastest-growing segment of the marketing business. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Next time you think about questioning the power of the Federal Reserve Board of the United States to move the markets, remember this week, will you? Oil's at record highs, the dollar is at record lows, and yet all it takes is a lousy rate cut and investors act as if they haven't got a care in the world. We'll have the details and the whole wild week on Wall Street when we do the numbers. Believe it or not, there's a fairly standard set of things that identity thieves do once they've made off with your good name and the numbers that go along with it. One of them, usually the first, is to open credit accounts, charge cards, revolving accounts at stores, all of that. Consumers lucky enough to catch the theft early naturally want to stop it, and barring the three big credit reporting bureaus from releasing their information is one way to do it. No background, no new credit account, right? But it's traditionally been awfully hard for consumers to get that done. Consumer groups and the credit bureaus themselves have been feuding for some time over when and how consumers can freeze their histories. But now there's a break in that battle, as Marketplace's Steve Tripoli tells us.
TransUnion, one of the big three, now says it will allow people in all 50 states to freeze their histories. Starting October 15th, they'll have to make a written request. Gail Hillebrand of Consumers Union likes having consumers get that right.
This means every consumer in the country will be able to lock up access to their TransUnion credit report and credit score and make their own decisions about who gets to see it for opening new credit.
But she says TransUnion should also allow people to do this by phone or over the web, and she says the $10 fee for a freeze is too high. Hillebrand calls this a good step, but says consumers won't be fully protected.
The most important thing that's missing is that the other two credit reporting agencies need to step up to the plate and match and exceed this offer.
That would be Equifax and Experian.
From the consumer's point of view, to lock up your file at TransUnion if you can't lock it up at Equifax and Experian is like locking the front door and leaving the back door and the window open.
35 states let consumers freeze their credit reports. Now TransUnion's taking it national. Today, David Rubinger of Equifax had this response.
We plan to extend this capability to the 15 other states, and we will be disclosing exactly how we're going to do that in the very near future.
Rubinger says Equifax held off up to now because it wanted to balance consumers' concerns with the needs of big lenders who ask for its reports. Experian didn't return our calls, but a spokesman told USA Today the company is analyzing the situation. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
You can check our website if you want to know whether your state lets you freeze your credit histories. It's marketplace.org. The South African economy is growing at a rate of almost 5% a year, and you can see signs of that prosperity in some of the major cities, where new cars and high-end shops have no want of buyers. But the 5% figure is averaged across the whole economy, the high end and the low. 13 years after South Africa's first fully democratic elections, the economic boom still hasn't trickled down to the poorest communities. Gretchen Wilson reports now from Holomisa, South Africa.
More than 4 million South Africans live in shacks without electricity or plumbing. Some are tired of waiting for government services, and they're taking to the streets in increasingly violent protests around the country. 3 weeks ago in Soweto, police fired rubber bullets at demonstrators in a protest over housing. The protesters sang, "It's bad, but we'll continue fighting for our rights, even if they shoot us."
There's a time bomb for us.
Sipa Mandla Zondi is with the Institute for Global Dialogue. He points out that despite South Africa's growth, 40% of adults still can't find jobs. The World Bank says the income gap here is among the highest in the world. It's created a tinderbox.
Under those conditions of affluence juxtaposed to abject poverty, you cannot relax.
Zondi says this popular unrest isn't new. It was common in other African nations after independence, and it's been the catalyst for both unscrupulous dictators and democratic opposition movements. When the ruling African National Congress, or ANC, doesn't deliver here in South Africa, other parties move in. In Holomisa, 100 miles south of Johannesburg, the United Democratic Movement has made big inroads. Matanzima Mokoena is a local official with that party. He says economic freedom hasn't come with democracy.
If you are in the freedom, you must get job. You must get proper infrastructures. But in this government, it's very slow.
The ANC government says it's going as fast as it can. The money's there, and it's already built 2 million basic houses, or 500 a day. Government officials say the neglect was so great under apartheid that they're trying to go from 0 to 60 in a way that few governments ever have. In some towns, people are impatient. They're fed up with local corruption, bribery, and nepotism. In July, protesters in Holomisa vandalized and set fire to this municipal building. Then some demonstrators kept going to the house of a local ANC councillor. They stoned him to death in front of his neighbors and children. A neighbor remembers what it was like.
Because they didn't have to kill somebody for service rendered, because they were supposed to talk with him, not to kill. It's so sad. Every time I think about it, I just want to cry.
Between these bouts of violence, most days are mundane but difficult. Elsie Gambu is washing dishes. She's made her shack of scavenged, rusty tin siding, old curtains, and tarps. She says economically, little has changed since the end of apartheid.
We don't feel free at all. The government is like it's not working for us. We don't feel free at all.
Gambu says she doesn't care about politics. All she knows is that she hasn't shared in her country's prosperity.
The situation right here, it makes us very feeling very down and lost in the middle of nowhere. Like, no one cares about us, no one thinks about us, you know.
In Holomisa, South Africa, I'm Gretchen Wilson for Marketplace.
Time to check the week on Wall Street with our stockbroker business analyst friend David Johnson down south a ways. Mr. Johnson, how are you?
I'm marvelous. Now you see why I grew the beard.
Why would that be?
Because I want to be like my man Ben Bernanke.
You know, get a life, right? I mean, come on. It was one lousy rate cut.
It was the biggest thing of the week, and it really made the week. And you look, you know, all the averages are up 3%, and at least this week they liked it.
Does it not sort of astound you that we're close to 14,000 again on the Dow?
It does, and it's been a long and it's been a very rocky road, and I don't know how much longer, you know, this market can rally. You look back, we're up, I guess, 800 points here, just in a matter of days. It was either a very bold move on the part of the Fed, a sort of silver bullet, a one and done, and right at the right time that we needed, or it was one of the most insidious things that you could possibly do, and it was sort of like walking by the punch bowl at an AA meeting and pouring in a little Everclear.
Yeah, well, extrapolate on that for a second, would you? Because it is sort of curious that it was so big and the double cut, I mean, the whole deal.
Well, the low interest rates, it's kind of a double-edged sword, and that's the Everclear comment. I mean, if it fuels back the economy and, you know, it's like the Greenspan put, and now it's the Bernanke put. If you can do any foolish thing you want to, hedge funds, and somebody's going to come along and bail you out. Now, it's much bigger than that. The economy, it's housing, so there's justification for it. But then there's the other side, the sort of soft, dark underbelly of it. Is so Bernanke and the guys give it to us on one hand, this rate cut and the big rally, but then on the other hand, taking it down because you see what's going on with oil.
Yeah.
You see what's going on with the U.S. dollar.
Indeed you do.
Well, a lot of that is tied to these lower interest rates and the weakness in the dollar and the adjustment upwards in the price of oil. And so, you know, they're taking it away over there.
Which is just not so good macroeconomically speaking. I mean, look out for me 6 months and what do you see?
Yeah, I know. And so that's why to really give an intelligent answer was this, you know, a stroke of genius move. And yeah, you got to wait a year, six months anyway, but I would argue maybe a year. The dollar is the thing. Well, there's several things we got to watch next week. We got to watch the dollar. We got to watch oil. And then there's this transportation average, my favorite leading indicator. Along comes FedEx yesterday, you know, this great representative company, and says our earnings are going to be lower than expected. My sense is, first of all, I don't like it. I don't like hearing from them because they're a good leading indicator. But my sense is we're probably going to hear more of that from other companies over the next couple of 3 weeks.
The theory being that so much of the commerce runs through FedEx and UPS and all those guys, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's sort of the leading indicator argument. The argument that other companies are going to be warning, well, that's kind of a function of, you know, what's been going on with credit and gasoline prices.
It never does. And David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. Thank you, David.
We've earned the weekend. Enjoy it, Kyle.
We have indeed. I will. We'll see you next time. Coming up, Halo 3 is hitting the market next week, so that's a big deal, right?
If they pull in $200 million in one day, that's you can't ignore that. In comparison, like Spider-Man 3 brought in $60 million its first day.
So then, yes, it is a big deal. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials hiked up 53 points today, a third of 1% to close at 13,820. The Nasdaq rose 0.6%, 16 points to close at 2671. The S&P 500 edged up 0.5%, 7 points, 1526 at the bell. For the week gone by, the Dow up 2.8%, the Nasdaq up 2.6%, the S&P 500 up 2.7%. Virtually all of that, by the way, in about 30 minutes after the rate cut announcement on Tuesday. Oracle rose 4.5% on news of a sharp jump in quarterly profits. Nike also had good earnings news, but it fell more than 1.75% today. Bonds traded up. The yield on the 10-year T-note slipped to 4.68%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. And by Consumer Consequences, American Public Media's online game, exploring what the world would be like if everyone on Earth consumed like you. Online at consumerconsequences.org. Marketplace is podcasting. Marketplace Takeout is a mix of our best stories from the past week, the cream of the crop from our reporters around the world, delivered to you on the go wherever you are. Want to sign up? Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link at the top of the page. Or you can download entire shows of Marketplace and Marketplace Money at audible.com.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Monday. In Washington, the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee discusses the impact of global climate change on wildfires in the U.S. The National Press Club holds its first video conference luncheon. Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad will speak and take questions. And a charming new All-American Family was introduced to television audiences on September 24, 1964, the Munsters. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Hard as this might be to believe, the government's about to run out of money. More accurately, the ability to borrow money. It's called the debt limit. This year will hit the current ceiling of nearly $9 trillion a week from Monday. Congress has had to raise its limit on the amount the Treasury Department's allowed to borrow four times since George W. Bush took office 6.5 years ago. Former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan wrote in his memoir that came out earlier this week he had expected Republicans to deliver smaller government and lower spending. Commentator Benjamin Barber says, Alan, you should have known better.
Alan Greenspan is only the latest in a long line of scholarly economists who, in their purism, don't get politics, a.k.a. hypocrisy. David Stockman, President Reagan's long-suffering OMB director, learned the hard way that Reagan's campaign rhetoric about across-the-board spending cuts to bring down the size of government was just that, campaign rhetoric. Once in office, Reagan applied fiscal restraint to health, education, and welfare spending, but not to entitlements or military spending. Government got bigger, and Stockman went home feeling betrayed. You can read about it in Stockman's scathing but naive book on the Reagan Revolution. Then there was the first Bush senior administration, read my lips, no more taxes, where government only got bigger even as the rich got tax breaks. So why should it be any different in the second Bush administration, where Greenspan's quiet advice to Bush to veto spending bills sent to him by a Republican Congress was, Greenspan complains, ignored? Fiscal restraint is a Republican mantra meant to combat those mischievous tax and spend Democrats. But it isn't real Republican policy. The real difference economically between Democrats and Republicans is not that one spends and the other doesn't, only what they are willing to spend for and whose taxes they are willing to raise or lower. Fiscal restraint isn't part of the political vocabulary, whatever side of the aisle politicians sit on. We can argue about whether this is good or bad. But economists like Greenspan make the mistake of thinking that the painful economic principle of self-restraint can actually be politically viable. That would require either statesmanlike leaders or disciplined citizens. And there's no sign that either are in the offing in this busy, rhetoric-mad campaign year.
Benjamin Barber is a distinguished senior fellow at the think tank Demos. Send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Figure out, if you can, the common thread linking the following: Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, High School Musical 2, the iPhone, and the Simpsons movie. A spring and summer of endless mind-numbing hype would be the answer you're looking for, and sadly, it's not over yet. This weekend brings the final push of a nearly year-long media blitz you might have managed to tune out, unless you live with a video gamer. Here's Marketplace's Lisa Napoli.
As soon as Sohail Masood cleaned out the Simpsons movie promotion stuff from his 7-Eleven store in Alexandria, Virginia last month, a new shipment of products arrived. A special new Slurpee concoction served up in special new 3D cups, special edition Doritos, and specially packaged cans of Pepsi.
It is a big, big promotion. Big, big.
All these brand name calories have been cooked up to hype a new video game that'll be released at the stroke of midnight Tuesday, a shoot 'em up production called Halo 3. The marketing blitz began last December on TV, on the web, and with all sorts of branded Halo products, including a brand new beverage.
Ah! No! Yes!
New Mountain Dew Game Fuel, cranked up for Halo 3. Chug it and have no mercy.
Even people who follow the gaming industry closely are surprised by the tens of millions of dollars sunk into promoting Halo 3, like game analyst and reviewer Greg Ford.
I've never seen anything like this before.
Ford says all the hype has created record-breaking pre-orders of the game, and it's expected to rake in as much as $200 million on its first day in the stores.
That's a lot of money, and if they pull in $200 million in one day, that's... You can't ignore that. In comparison, like Spider-Man 3 brought in $60 million its first day.
The fact that sales of video games in the U.S. now rival Hollywood box office take is making Madison Avenue take note. Ken Chan is a marketing expert in Los Angeles. He says game producers have to roll out their creations with a bang, because otherwise the stores that distribute them won't stock them.
These retail guys just have a limited amount of shelf space, and they're increasingly putting pressure on publishers and asking them, you know, how much money are you going to put behind this title? And if you're not going to put that much, then you're not going to earn shelf space.
After all, shelf space is to video games what movie screens are to Tinseltown. Chan says more and more the gaming industry is behaving like Hollywood with its high-stakes, make-it-or-break-it opening weekends. Games now have bigger budgets, more stars, larger audiences, and therefore lots more marketing potential.
If you're an advertiser like Mountain Dew, you can spend the money on traditional TV, but it's probably not going to give you the effectiveness that you could get directly targeting gamers and speaking their language.
Chan says now that the advertising industry has learned to speak the language, it's logical what will happen next. Just like Hollywood, they'll start slipping their products right into the games. I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. And by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note from our IPO rumors desk here at Marketplace, there's word Prada might be moving forward with an initial public offering. According to Bloomberg News this afternoon, the Milan-based fashion house could offer shares in early 2008. At $5.5 billion, it would be the biggest IPO in the luxury goods industry. That has been the part of the economy going strong in the face of the recent slowdown. Also today, news of a deal gone bad. The private equity firm KKR and Goldman Sachs have backed out of their plan to buy the audio tech company Harman International. The $8 billion deal was arranged earlier this year, that is to say in those halcyon days before the subprime squeeze. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 52 points, a third of 1%. That's about 100 points shy of Dow 14,000, if you can believe it. The NASDAQ bumped up 16 points, 0.6%. The S&P 500 up 7 points, 0.5% there. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Coming up on Monday.
Glück auf, Glück auf.
It's a song about coal mining in Germany. We'll figure it out for you Monday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.